afternoon. It's a great honor for us to welcome Mr. Jack Valenti to Duke Law School today for the third annual Meredith and Kip Frye Lecture in Intellectual Property. This annual lecture series was established by Meredith and Kip to bring top academics and leading figures in the field of intellectual property to Duke Law School to stimulate debate on real-world intellectual property topics of great importance. As you know, intellectual property is a strategic priority for us here at Duke Law School. We have attracted some of the best scholars in intellectual property in the country, both full-time faculty members and adjunct professors who form an intellectual cluster which few schools can begin to match in terms of creativity, visibility, and importance in the field. This is a place with not only outstanding faculty, but outstanding students who have found lots of ways to add to the distinction of Duke Law School in intellectual property through participating in legal briefs, putting on special conferences, and other activities. I want to mention one of these activities today, the second annual Hot Topics Conference coming up on March 21st will feature some of the country's leading judges and practitioners discussing the latest issues in copyright and patent law. The Frye Lecture Series has attracted Larry Lessig from Stanford Law School and last year Yochai Benkler from NYU Law School. And you can tell from this spread of individuals that the idea of this lecture series is not to shy away from controversial topics, but to generate open debate about them. This year is no exception, and I very much look forward to hearing speak today the most prominent spokesman for the movie industry. I've asked Professor David Lang, one of the most well-known intellectual property scholars in the country, to introduce Mr. Valenti. Professor Lang.
And I do so with very great pleasure, sir. It's an honor to have you with us today, and a great pleasure for me to be the person who is to introduce you. Jack Valenti was born in Texas, served in the U.S. Army Air Corps' 12th Air Force as a bomber pilot in missions flown over the Italian Alps in the vicinity of the Brenner Pass, 51 missions altogether. I am told at heights generally amounting to about 100 feet above the ground, occasionally rising to perhaps a few thousand feet, but remembering always that the Italian Alps are higher than a few thousand feet. So this was not a small thing that Jack Valenti did in the 3 years and 51 missions that he served during World War II. And I think it began a career that I believe makes him more than ordinarily suited to be the president and CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America, because if any CEO and president has led a life that is truly the life of an adventurer, worthy of portrayal by Sean Connery or others.
Danny DeVito.
It must be exactly. Must surely be Jack Valenti. He said at breakfast this morning that perhaps the most hair-raising trip he'd had while flying during the war was coming home when he sort of island-hopped from place to place in this B-25 bomber, finally landing safely in the United States. He took an MBA at Harvard, went back to Texas, formed an advertising firm with a partner, and in the course of doing so, we're now to nearly the end of the 1950s, he began to be increasingly drawn into political consulting, especially for Democrats. He became allied with the Kennedy administration, and in November of 1963 in Dallas was given the task of coordinating publicity for the then much anticipated visit by President Kennedy and the First Lady to Dallas. Jack Valenti was in the sixth car in the presidential motorcade when the president was assassinated at Dealey Plaza. Later that afternoon on Air Force One, he was the first presidential assistant sworn in on behalf of Lyndon Johnson, whom he served from that day until 1966 in June, when he left to become the head of the Motion Picture Association of America. Among his first challenges at the Motion Picture Association was the challenge posed by First Amendment threats consisting of censorship. There were, in those days, numerous censorship boards in various cities around the country. Jack Valenti, with others, but chiefly at his direction, designed the Motion Picture Association rating code, which we have known from that time until this, and which has served, I think, most of us would agree, admirably as a way to distinguish among pictures we wish to see ourselves, wish to see with our spouses, and wish not to have our children see. He is among the most thoughtful, committed, and articulate spokesmen for the motion picture industry's continuing battles against digital piracy, the thing which I think it would be fair to say probably occupies him most and occupies the association most. We may or we may not agree with his position on this subject, but there is no gainsaying the dimensions of the problem. Every day of the year, approximately 500,000 films are downloaded from the Internet without permission and without payment. It would be remarkable if the motion picture industry were indifferent to statistics of this kind and others like it, and indeed, as we all know, the industry is anything but indifferent. So it is appropriate and indeed very welcome that our guest, Jack Valenti, will speak to us today on the moral dimensions of this great phenomenon of our time. Let us welcome Jack Valenti.
Thank you very much, David, for that introduction. A little brief, but that's all right. Anyway, it's kind of you, and more than I deserve. First thing I'm going to do is start my stopwatch. But I got to tell you a story about this. When I was a small boy growing up in Houston, Texas, growing up Catholic and the grandson of Sicilian peasants, in a part of Texas that was the Bible Belt, where there were very few Catholics, and you can bet your bottom dollar, damn fewer Sicilians, I can tell you that. I used to go to Mass with my family at 7 a.m. every Sunday. And then, I would go with my Protestant buddies to what is known in Texas as the Brush Arbor Revival. On a flat piece of parched Texas earth, they have a tent, 500 folding chairs, and a pulpit where circuit-riding preachers would come in for a couple of hours, kick the hell out of the devil all the way up and down this Texas flatlands. And one day I was with a 10-year-old friend of mine and his father, and there approaches the pulpit this preacher who's known to be the greatest filibustering preacher of all time, could go 4 to 5 hours and never have to go to the bathroom. That's a terrible situation. So the first thing he did is he hauled out a big pocket watch and put it right in front of him. And my young friend tugged at his daddy, and he said, "Daddy, what does it mean when the preacher takes out that watch?" And the father leaned down and he said, "Son, not a goddamn thing." So I'm starting my stopwatch. Dean Bartlett, thank you so much. I had a chance to visit Duke Law School today, and as a fellow who always wanted to be a lawyer and somehow took the crooked path, I was very impressed, particularly with the technological advances that you have. I thought I was on a Star Trek set for a while there. It's incredible what you have done. I'm going to try to speak with you as brief a time as I can, and then perhaps we can have questions, because I think you and I talking together about this is something that's useful. I'm glad to hear that you had Larry Lessig here. Larry and I have debated four times, I guess, and I find him a thoroughly charming and brilliant man, although we're on the opposite sides of just about everything, including the Eldridge decision, which I sat in the Supreme Court. And I told one of my friends it's going to be a 7-2 decision. Unfortunately, I didn't pick the right justice. I got Breyer right, but I didn't get the other one right. But Larry and I take our little show on the road, kind of like Snappy Songs and Snappy Patter, and we get along wonderfully well. So I have here 2 pages of my speech, and I hope that you'll allow me to bore you a little bit. But let me begin by saying no free democratic country, no free democratic country can lay claim to greatness if it doesn't construct some kind of a moral platform, a moral imperative, if you will, to guide the society and have the society recognize and respect civic trust. This moral imperative applies to every business, every industry, every profession, every university, and the government as well. It is defined by what William Faulkner called the old verities, words that really illuminate what a free and loving land is all about. Words like duty, honor, service, integrity, pity, pride, compassion, sacrifice. Now, if you regard these words casually, if you find them uncool, or if you treat them as mere playthings that only the rubes and the rabble and the unsophisticated and the unlearned observe and honor, then I'll tell you, my friends, you and I will witness the slow undoing of the great secret of America, without any question. Now, newspapers lately have been full of sordid stories of the unbounded avarice of a lot of corporate executives who did some, well, I guess whose acts soiled this moral compact. Now, it wasn't an indictment of the free market system. The system works just fine. But what was contemptibly and horribly wrong was these executives knew they were cheating and stealing from their employees and their stockholders. And because it was easy to do and they had the power to do it, they did it. Now, I must tell you in all honesty that this was a cynical and coarse defiance of the moral compact. And the exposure of this fiscal perfidy had a lot of people thinking hard and long about the lack of a moral reverence, moral reference within these corporate executives. Now, most Americans who don't have very much really don't resent people who have more, because most Americans believe if they work hard, if they educate themselves, if they go to Duke Law School, they will, by their own efforts, have more tomorrow than they have today. That is the beauty and the sanity of the American dream. But I must tell you, the belief by the average citizen in the moral compact is demolished by the brute reality that some of those who have more got theirs through trickery and treachery and duplicity, and thereby soil the moral compact. I think that there is no larger objective in this country, no larger objective than the reassembling of civic trust in this country. Trust not only in business leaders, but in university leaders, in lawyers and doctors, and in the politicians, those people who govern us, to believe that they are doing everything they can to benefit the people that they have by solemn oath sworn to serve. Now, someone once said that all movement is not necessarily forward, and that all change is not necessarily progress. Now, the digital world that we're about to enter may not be a better world, but it sure as hell is different. The difference between digital and analog is, in the words of Mark Twain, the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. Huge chasm. And therein lies both the menace and the promise. Now, most universities, I'd say all of them, including Duke, have large pipe, high velocity, state-of-the-art broadband systems. None better, none faster. And these systems produce vast benefits to the university, allowing professors and research experts to have instant access to all the latest data, information. And I saw a demonstration today of how you can examine all the law cases since the time of Lycurgus, I guess, or Solon at least. I'm not moving too fast for this group, am I? I want you to stay with me. So, excuse me. Now, the students themselves are also have access to all this material. enormous avalanche of it, and access to movies as well. Now, the fact is, it's an open sesame opportunity, like it or not, for students to get on these file swapping sites and guess what? Take down movies by the long ton without paying for it. Now, that's the state of affairs today. So I want to talk to you a little bit today about the interlacing of digital technology, the moral compact, and movies. And I want to introduce you to a collision of values, which is very important, particularly for those of you who are students and going into the practice of law. One value says the digital technology gives me power to roam the internet. And whatever is available there, I have the power to take it down, and I do. The other value says the fact that digital technology gives me all this power doesn't make it right for me to use it wrongly. And there, my young friends, is the collision of values today. And I'll tell you this. We confront, as a result, a massive contradiction. Because this collision puts to hazard the whole sustenance of the moral compact. And it brings to question, what are the universities going to do about it? How do you respond to this gauntlet thrown down to you, universities, by the best and the brightest? Now, David referred to some statistics. He was referring to Viant, which is a Boston-based research firm, that recently estimated that 400,000 to 600,000 movies are being illegally taken into hard drives every 24 hours today. And this means that students, mainly, unfortunately, are the biggest chunk of the recipients of these movies, where you flee at 183,000 miles a second to Morpheus and Kazaa and Nutella and Grokster and LimeWire and you name it, where you can enter somebody else's hard drive and bring down the world free of charge. Nobody bothering you. Not too bad. But there's a larger, darker issue here that we just simply have to confront. 99.9% of students in universities today would never go into a Blockbuster store, as my colleagues Troy Dow and Terry Southwick, who are here in teaching intellectual property, have tried to present in far more eloquent terms than I am. They wouldn't dream of going into a Blockbuster store and with furtive glance put a DVD under your jacket and walk out without paying. Wouldn't do that. Why? It's stealing. It's shoplifting. It's the Winona Ryder thing. And they wouldn't do it because they know if they get caught, they're in big-ass trouble. So why is it that these same young, brilliant people will go to the internet and stuff inside their computers a movie into their digital hard drive? Why? Why is that so? Is it because digital shoplifting is a low-risk enterprise? If that is so, why is it so? Is it because Ambrose Bierce's definition of conscience is something you refer to when you're about to get caught? Is that an unwanted truth? Are the words principle, ethics, morality, alien words exiled from a student's lexicon? I pray that is not so. But we have to examine it. Now, I know some critics say, oh, come on, movie industry. God damn it. Get with it. Stop your whining and get a new business model. Hey, that's not a bad idea. Except that no business model ever struck off by the hand and brain of man can compete with free. If you can get it free, there's no business model you can think of. Believe me. And if somebody says, come down to the Safeway or whatever your grocery store equivalent is, and pack up everything, and somebody across the street is trying to sell it to you, guess who's going to do the most business? Same way with us. Now, let me tell you a story, true story. I'm not going to tell you the name of this university. It's one of the, maybe one of the top five of the most prestigious universities in this country. I was asked to speak on the changing American presidency. Every now and then I like to talk about politics because I'm a political animal at best, sometimes at worst, too. And before I started with about 250 of the top people there, students, I said, before I begin my little comment, I'm not in the music business, it's not my turf, but I'm curious. This was a couple years ago when Napster was in full blossom. I said, how many of you have bought a CD in the last couple of months? Two hands went up. And then I said, how many of you are on Napster? Every bloody hand went up. And I said, that's interesting. And I picked out a young fellow, about like you, who's going to graduate near the top of his class. And I said, let me ask you a question. Here you are about to become an educated, civilized human being, best fitted to face life challenges and changes and dangers, and to do it all with versatility and grace. So how do you square that with the fact that you're stealing? Well, he was pretty crestfallen at first. And his face brightened. He said, well, I guess it is a kind of stealing. But heck, everybody else is doing it, and besides, music costs too much. And I thought, as I smiled, I thought to myself, and for this course in moral ethics, parents are spending a bloody fortune in tuition. I know I'm going too fast for you now. I don't think the university can stand aloof from this progression. The university is the guardian of purpose for young people who come to its undergraduate and its graduate levels. And the university set the final design, not only for your intellectual expansion, but for the morality in which you're going to invest in all the work that you do. Can't stand aloof from that. I'm pleased to report that right now, the movie industry is meeting with a committee representing universities and colleges. I spoke with Dean Bartlett about that today. The top people, Rick Levin, president of Yale, Charles Phelps, chancellor of Rochester, Graham Spanier, the president of Penn State, and John Hennessy, the president of Stanford. We're trying to work together to see if the universities, not me, not the movie people, but the universities can construct a code of conduct. Like Ayala University have the honor system. A code of conduct that would guide the activities of students in this new internet world of zeros and ones. With everything within the confines and the authority of the university, not us. If we come to the university with explicit evidence of copyright infringement, we turn it over to the university. And they do whatever they want to with it. But there has to be. You can't live in this world without some kind of a code of conduct. That's what a moral compact is all about. And the societies that are extinguishing history are those that played fast and loose with the moral covenant. I don't want to sound pious. I don't want to sound idealistic. But I'm telling you, there are some things which are ancient, which are ageless. And the moral conduct of a human being is one of those. Now, the digital technology is a hyper-modern phenomenon, no question about that. But its molecular connection to the moral compact has an ancient ancestry. Many, many years ago, if you haven't read this British philosopher, you ought to, writes readable prose, marvelous insights. William Hazlitt once wrote that man is the only animal who both laughs and weeps, because man is the only animal who understands the difference between the way things are and the way they ought to be. God, that encompasses all the strands that bind together every society. And so I think the digital world has the capacity to unlock such information, such facts, such knowledge that previously had behind doors partially open or closed to all but a few. What is yet to be put in place is a clear understanding on the part of everybody that while you have this immense new digital power, you never had it before, you do not use it to injure others. Now, I'm absolutely fascinated with what I'm saying up here right now, but I'm going to stop at this point, which is about 17 minutes after I began. and ask you if it's possible that we can join in colloquy. Is that a good word? And I want to hear from you. I want to discuss this issue. I feel very passionately about it. I try to instill it in my own young children. Well, not so young now. And young people I work with. One day, most of you will be in command positions in some enterprise. Maybe it's a law firm, maybe it's a business. And you're going to find younger people doing darker things that you don't think is right, taking that which does not belong to you. How will you confront that? Because guess what? It'll be on your dime. So, can we do that? Is that possible? Who wants to be the first olive out of the bottle? Do we have a microphone? Can you go back and use this mic? I can hear you, but I want everybody else to hear you. Well, maybe I won't hear you. I don't know. Maybe I won't want to hear you.
I'm curious what you feel about the tension between the possibility of exposure through these really fast forms of media and communication in contrast with the reality of people downloading vast amounts of music and movies without paying for it.
What is your question?
Well, I'm curious what you feel. I mean, how the media could be useful, because there are a lot of useful ways for exposure of artists or in the film industry, directors and filmmakers, but without, while at the same time promoting that moral code that you're discussing.
Well, I think if a director or a songwriter or an author wants to give away his material, this is Larry Lessig talking about the Creative Commons. I have no problem with that. But unless you're under the GI Bill of Rights, which I was fortunately able to be under and got all my tuition and all my books free. When you come to Duke, don't you have to pay something? You don't go and steal books to come here, do you? I know stealing is a hard word, but let me put it this way. What do you define as the act of taking something intellectually alive that doesn't belong to you, for which you do not pay and you do not ask the permission of the owner? How do you describe that? Sampling? Hello, that's not bad, is it? But if I don't choose for you to sample it, people work years on getting a movie out. It costs, you can go see $100 million movie for about $5, $6, $7 in a theater. You can go into a Blockbuster store and buy a DVD that lasts forever for under $15. You can rent it. Dollar or two. It's the biggest bargain on earth. When you buy a Mercedes or a Volvo, every time you buy that car, there's a profit in that car. Otherwise, those birds wouldn't be in business very long. But a $100 million movie has got to go through a tremendous number of marketing venues. 2 out of 10 pictures never get their money back from theatrical exhibition. They have to go to Blockbuster and Showtime and cable and television international. 4 out of 10 pictures never get their money back. The average cost in 2001 to make and market an average major studio film was $80 million. Now, I don't know about you, but I count that to be serious money. And yet, 400,000 to 600,000 movies are taken every day. How long can that last? There are only 17 million, approximately, homes with broadband. But what happens, my young friend, when you get 20, 30, 40, 50 million homes on broadband? And the technology we find so magical today will seem primitive 18 months from now. You bring down a movie in minutes. How do we go into that future? If people, particularly universities, find nothing wrong, it's okay to do this. I didn't mean to give you a lecture, but I told you more than you really wanted to know. Yes, sir, and then I'll come to you.
I almost fear the answer. I'm going to ask a question.
You're going to give me the answer. God, that's wonderful.
No. I fear the answer. I don't. I won't give it. When we're talking about stealing, this is a it's an unusual world because it's not, it's as though one could walk into Blockbuster, stick the tapes under their jacket, leave, and the tapes stay there. And it's a world where people seem intuitively to not see this activity as stealing. It's very different than anything that's gone on before. A movie can be downloaded and the movie's still there. So as a morality, it's a new morality. And people seem to be forming a morality that's different than the morality you're talking about. And I'm just wondering how we take into account this kind of stealing where nothing is physically gone, only ideas. And we don't tend to think about stealing ideas.
But it's not an idea. It's something that has been completed. It cost $100 million to take that idea, which is a script. Then you populate it with directors, producers, and actors, and grips, and everybody. It's $100 million. The fact that it is intellectual makes it no less valuable than a table that you make or a car that you manufacture. I don't think it's a new morality at all. Morality is as old as recorded history. We still live by this ancient, when Charlton Heston brought it down, for God's sake, the Ten Commandments. We still live by that. In 1787, when these 55 guys got together in Philadelphia, they were doing something that was new, but they based it on ageless, changeless ideas and ideals, basing it on writings of Montesquieu and all of those who lived 100 years before them. There are no new morality. There might be new applications of the way that, but morality is morality. It is there. It is unchanging. And when you take something, it doesn't belong to you. In whatever form that it's in. I don't know how you define it. I tried to figure out some synonym for stealing, and I came up with internet abuse. But it's a synonym. So that's my answer I give you. Now, I know my colleagues Terry Southwick and Troy Dow meet with some young people in intellectual property. And it's very difficult for young people to make this absorption, to understand that what they're doing is wrong. Now, if this is the new society, if 10-year-olds and 11-year-olds grow up believing it's not wrong to do that, it's a short step to something else. I'm not being a lamentable Cassandra here, but have to think about that. Yes, sir.
Well, I'd like to step back for a moment from examining the moral deterioration of society and admit for the moment that everyone in this room probably believes that stealing is criminal, theft of intellectual property is theft, and it's not only immoral but illegal. Now, there's an aspect of copyright law called fair use. Fair use is that use which promotes additional creativity and provides new content based on to some degree on previously copyrighted material. Now, you've discussed a moral imperative, and it's important that there is a moral compact with today's society and with future generations. One of your largest member corporations, the Disney Corporation, has produced content based on many occasions on older stories developed by previous generations, some in the public domain and some not. They've appropriated these older stories and produced them and reproduced them as their own. How can you justify putting fences around sources of content for the next generation of inspired creators using the digital rights technologies that your organization is currently supporting and promoting for future generations?
I think that's a very insightful question. Let's talk about fair use. You may not be surprised to know you're not the first one who's flung that two-word phrase at me. What is fair use? Fair use is any professor in this school can go to the Blockbuster store, get a DVD or a video cassette, and show it in its entirety in your classroom without paying a performance fee. You have a right to do reference material, although some authors will overstep the bounds by quoting the people. You can take maybe a page out of a chapter. You can't take the whole book. That's part of the law. Now, when you talk about Disney taking previous material, Shakespeare went down and had previous material to the 17th century. Everybody does that. But you either live under a country of laws or you don't. Now, there are copyright laws in this country. If you think they are unfair and unwise and unwieldy and absolutely out of kilter in this new zero and one age, then we change the law. But right now, I think as a lawyer to be, are you a lawyer?
No, I'm not a lawyer.
Are you in law school?
I'd like to clarify my question. I'm not asking whether I don't believe that Disney broke the law in their taking of this content. My question is more the technologies the organization is promoting.
Well, what technology are we promoting?
Digital rights management technologies, which would restrict access to content provided through many media. These technologies would prevent access for fair uses without inordinate hurdles to be jumped over by the user of that content for a legitimate use.
Well, let me ask you this question. Let's say I have a movie on pay-per-view. This movie comes right after a new business model, comes right after theatrical exhibition. It has yet to go into all the other venues. We put it on the air, send it down, pay-per-view. Is it fair use to make a copy of that without paying for it?
Certainly not.
Well, that's my point. That makes my point. Fair use doesn't mean you take something that doesn't belong to you. Now, we're not restricting anything.
I don't mean to interrupt, sir.
Well, you just did.
Yes. I'd like to try and focus. I'm discussing actual fair use, not the perception of fair use.
Well, I think we can debate this because I think you and I are going like this, and you're as right as I'm right, I suppose, but I don't want to. I got other people. So thank you very much.
To come off of his question, which you mentioned, the difference between legal and moral, and I don't think a lot of people would argue with you that stealing is moral or immoral, but how do you square, for example, the DGA's position going further into people's homes that may want to watch a movie without cursing or without nudity to change it after they've actually purchased the movie themselves so they can watch it in the manner that they want to, where the DGA have said that they don't want this type of stuff to happen? How do you square those two issues?
That's a good question. You're talking about clean flicks and that sort of thing, where you take a video cassette and you insert some software in it, and it changes what's in that movie. Now, it takes out the words. It also takes out certain scenes that the software says is offensive and maybe violent sex and language. Now, the DGA takes the position that when a director makes film, and this is the prevailing judgment in Europe today, where they so-called moral rights, where the director, whatever he does, is sacrosanct. And the DGA says it's wrong for somebody to change the movie that I've made without consulting with me. Now, keep in mind that the major studios, when they prepare a film for airline, the airline version is edited by the director. And he then edits it for airline, so that you take out language, you omit certain sensuality scenes and certain violence. But it's done by the director and the copyright owner together. But to have somebody else take something that somebody has spent years working on. Now, I've seen some of these movies, as you might suspect. I've looked at them with the software. Do you realize that in Saving Private Ryan, they took out about 12 minutes of the opening scene? To me, that's sacrilege. I think Saving Private Ryan is a movie that every mother and every boy over the age of 13 ought to see. It shows the brutality and the inhumanity of war, and these people took it out. That's not what Steven Spielberg wanted to say. So I have to say on that score, I stand with the DGA.
But does that not cross a line in the home to where a person has a right to determine what's offensive and what's not offensive, and what they should, particularly if they have purchased the right to do that and not distributing to anyone else, but purchased the right for themselves to do it?
They purchased the right to see that movie in the form the director made it. It didn't give it the right to change it. There's no right there to change it. Now, you have an alternative. Every movie is not made for children. I've said that over and over again. You have the greatest right in the world, and that is you want exile the movie from your home. That's the best advice I can give. Yes, sir.
First off, thanks for coming here today. It's always good to see another Sicilian actually making progress in society. But my question is...
Are you available to do sitcom work?
I'm going to be here all week. My question is that you said a few minutes ago that, DVDs and digital material, you know, last forever, and that we don't need to worry about a lot of the degradation problems that we had with VHS. Well, actually, for Valentine's Day, I got my wife a multi-disc DVD set. I got her the first season of Friends. And unfortunately, one of our neighbor's children visited and decided to use the second disc as a plate for some Play-Doh cookies that she was making. So that disc is gone. And, you know, I hunted around, but I couldn't find any software that would allow me to actually make a backup copy of these. So, you know, when I go out and I have to buy a whole replacement of this whole set just for the second disc, I don't know if I'm going to be able to make a backup copy of it, just because a lot of the things that I've seen have said that you know, they're going to run afoul of legal problems. So I'm just asking you, you know, do you think it should be legal for me to take you know, a movie that I've purchased and make a backup copy of it, even if that requires me to you know, get around some copyright protection, just because it's not
some
offered
copyright.
In either way? Yeah.
Let me ask you this way. You go to the department store and you buy 6 cocktail glasses. You come home with them, and your child breaks them. Do you go back to the department store and say, I want some backup copies of this? The answer is, you don't. On the other hand, if you go to any place, you get some stationery that you've had printed, and it gets wet. You go to the stationery and say, I'm sorry, I need a backup for this. They look at you as if you've taken leave of your senses. The answer is, you've got a great way to get a backup. Go purchase it from Blockbuster. Just like you'd purchase some more glasses. Just like you'd get some new stationery. You see, there is this view which distorts. It takes intellectual property and makes it different from glasses. But it's not different. It is property. It belongs to somebody. Spent millions of dollars to produce it. And they haven't made a profit on it yet. And then you want a backup copy. I mean, forgive me if I seem a little surprised at this, though I'm not, because you're not the first one to say that either. But does that parallel seem compatible with you or not?
Well, my point is that, so for example, with the stationery, if it was incredibly important, I could always go over to a Xerox machine and make a backup copy, like if it was a
wet stationery?
No, I could take the original before it was damaged and just
come
as a precautionary measure.
How about the glasses?
Well, if I was very fanatical, I guess I could always try and mold one myself.
If you take some engraved stationery and you Xerox it, the value of that is quite deteriorated. It's not the engraved stationery. But you and I don't. The fact is, no, you cannot make a backup copy of a DVD. If for nothing else, you're breaking the law. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act says you can't circumvent the encryption. And that's the only way you'd make a backup copy.
So you feel that the
law... I beg your pardon?
So I'm just to clarify, you feel that the law should stand that any sort of circumvention is circumvention and that...
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Should a library be able to make a copy for a backup?
No. Do they make a backup copy of a book? The answer is no. They buy another book. Do they make a copy of a magazine that's in a library? No. They buy another magazine. I beg your pardon? What's out of print? If the book is out of print, where do they find it? They have to go to Amazon.com the way I do, for God's sakes, and find an out of print copy, which I've done several times. But nobody gave it to me. Libraries, every book you see in a library has been bought. The libraries will stack DVDs for you to rent, but they buy them. They don't make copies of them. Excuse me. Go ahead.
before I start my question, I'd like to say that I'm also a big fan of the free market and a big proponent of, self-regulating schemes like the MPAA's own rating system and what you're proposing now with the universities. But I'd like to – you talked about the liberty of the free market and how well it's working currently despite the problems you've been having with Enron and the others. Mr. Hazlett also said that the love of liberty is the love of others and the love of power is the love of ourselves. How does that square with the MPAA's support of legislation that would seek to control every computer made or sold in America by requiring digital rights management in every processor, from a microwave to a supercomputer? Does that not seem to be an immense hubris for the MPAA to seek to seek the power to limit the use of computers by every American?
Tell you what I'll do. Give you a free pass to every movie in America if you can cite me one bill before the Congress today that does that.
Well, it's not before the Congress, but it's currently being drafted, the CBPTA.
There is no legislation to do that right now. There is none in the 108th Congress, because any bill that was put in the 107th Congress is dead. You got to start all over again. There is no legislation sponsored by the MPA that does what you just said.
Can I change my question into previous sponsorship? Or potential future sponsorship?
You're talking about the Hollings bill.
Yes.
Now, the Hollings bill is kind of like, it's a boogeyman. You know what the Hollings bill said? Are you aware of what it says?
I thought I was, but I'm sure. I'd like to hear it from your mouth,
I'm sure you know, but I'm just going to refresh your memory. The Hollings bill said, and by the way, this was all done by Senator Hollings, not by me or the MPA, and I've learned a lot in Washington. Never argue with the chairman of the Senate Commerce Committee. Okay? You don't do that. This bill said, we're going to ask the IT, the computer people, and the consumer electronics people, and the copyright people, to sit down and talk together for as long as 18 months. 18 months. And at the end of 18 months, you can't come to any conclusions as to how you go into the future digital world. Then the Register of Copyrights and the Federal Communications Commission would then put out an order saying we want everybody in the country to offer what they think the solutions are. It's the most transparent democratic way I can imagine, that thousands of people would have sent in what they thought. The FCC would distill all this, make it all public so everybody can read it, and then they would do reply comments so that of the 5,000 briefs they received, there'll be 5,000 reply comments. And then after that comes in, they would hold a hearing in which they would distill everything and put it up for then oral discussion. It may take a year, 2 years, 3 years, who knows? But I can't think of anything that's more democratic than that. And that's what the Hollings bill said.
I'm not doubting that the process is democratic. However, at the end of a whole process, no matter how long the process is and how not prone to failure it's supposed to be, I'm sorry, I don't know if you said what the purpose of all those comments were and all those suggestions. What was the ultimate?
Excuse me. Go ahead, finish.
The ultimate goal.
The ultimate goal is that after everybody made all their comments, the FCC and the Register of Copyrights, one is under the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee, one is under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Committee, then they would distill all this and come up with what they thought ought to be the answer. But then they would hold open hearings about it.
The answer to what?
Answer to how to protect property in the digital age.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think my question is probably a little more tame than some of these are. But
can you speak up just a little bit?
I'm sorry. I think my question is probably a little more tame than some of these are. But so I have a friend of mine who lives in Japan. She sends me DVDs of the latest anime, which is just a cartoon sort of thing that I like to watch. I can't watch them here legally because my region for my DVD player is Region 1, which is the United States, mm-hmm. and I think it's Region 5 or Region 6 or something like that for Japan. And the end result is there's no way for me to watch them without buying a Japanese DVD player, except I could use the tools that are available on the Internet, like the one that was posted by the Eldridge case, DECSS, to crack the encryption on the DVD and play it on my Linux machine or on my Windows machine or whatever I wanted to do. By allowing a region set, and so I'm wondering, is that not consistent with fair use? Should I have to buy another DVD player in order to play that DVD, or what if I happen to move all over the world? Should I have to continue to buy different DVD players with whichever region I want to watch?
Let me respond to you by telling you why we have regional codes. called parallel imports. You put out a DVD here, but you don't put it out all over the world at the same time. So that what happens is that pirates would steal all the DVDs here, then ship them by transport to Japan or Asia or Europe, and flood the marketplace with DVDs. What we do now is when you bring out a DVD in Japan, it's coded to that Asian. If you bring it out in Europe, it's coded to Europe. And the Western Hemisphere is coded there. It has to do with trying to protect the vitality of a movie before it has a chance to move around the world.
But I'm not a pirate. I didn't do anything wrong. Why is everyone being treated like pirates?
Well, I wouldn't be dealing with a Japanese code. I'd try to get one in America if you
could.
But
these don't ever produce there. They're only produced in Japan. But they're really good cartoons. In all honesty, they're different than anything else. Sony produces them over there, but
they're really good cartoons. Then I would get me a Japanese machine and show them.
The problem is the Japanese ones are like $400. It just doesn't seem reasonable for me to have to buy a Japanese DVD player in order to do that. And I just think that I'm not really violating any rules. I'm not even trying to break the spirit. I'm breaking the letter of the law, but I'm definitely not breaking the spirit of the law. And it seems like a pretty reasonable thing for me to say, hey, is this okay? Because that's really what we're looking for, and just something simple like that.
Well, you make a good case, and I never felt comfortable with coding myself, to be honest with you. But it certainly was abusing the marketing of our films, because since you can't put out a film day and day all over the world, it's just from a marketing standpoint, it's more than your resources can handle. And you're trying to protect the vitality of that movie, and they came up with regional coding.
From a personal standpoint, buying another DVD player is more than my resources can handle.
Well,
and
let me know,
frankly,
and I'll try to get you a discount
if
you want.
Than I do for me. I appreciate that. Okay. But the thing is that you need to issue discounts for everybody. Because there are a lot of folks who are in the same boat. And there are people in our armed services who travel from place to place, who buy movies at that location. They come home, and they're just suddenly out of luck. People who buy a DVD if they're stationed in Germany, maybe in Italy.
No, your point's well taken. I'm not going to argue that point, because that's an artificial barrier that's put up in order to save, the future of these films abroad.
But it's an artificial barrier that y'all's organization and the corporations behind it put up. You have the power to take it down.
Well, the reason why you put it up, though, and again, I don't want to sound like a broken record here, if you'll pardon it, a broken DVD, is that we lose $3.5 billion a year in analog piracy. God knows how much we lose in the duplication of DVDs all over the world. It's mounting now into the billions, and it's becoming even more deleterious as time goes on. This was just a measure trying to protect the revenues. Now, maybe there are 10,000 people that have the same problem you have, and you got to measure. This is Jerry Bentham used to say, the greatest good for the greatest number of people. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're operating on right now. But I thank you.
Thank you.
You said before that you had an opportunity to speak with Professor Lessig and that he's a brilliant man and he had a lot of views that run counter to yours. If you could step outside of your position with the MPAA and just look at the facts objectively, what would be the most persuasive facts on the other side, not in favor of the motion picture industry?
I've been unable to find one. No, because Lessig is less radical than most people, I have to tell you. Lessig believes what he calls the Creative Commons. And by the way, I did a little video congratulating him on the Creative Commons and sent it there. I sent him a note and I said, Larry, you can play this, but having me say something at your conference may destroy your reputation. At any rate, what he's saying is that there's a copyrighted symbol you put on something that you can't use without permission to own it. But there's another symbol you put on it that you can use because the copyright owner says, I want everybody in the world to have this. I think that's eminently fair. No problem. If I want to let anybody in the world use my car for whatever reason, that's my business. I own the car. And I thought Larry's point on that was something to which I could subscribe.
Thank you.
Hello. I wanted to follow up on the question by your fellow Sicilian about the glasses, where you mentioned if you bought glasses at a store and they broke, you wouldn't expect a store to replace them. I kind of feel that that's an inadequate analogy.
I thought you might.
And the reason why is because if I decided to blow my own glasses and they looked like glasses that somebody else made, I wouldn't be violating any law. But what you've been saying this whole afternoon is that if I choose to download a film that you made without actually taking it away from you, without taking the physical DVD away from you, that not only is it wrong and it's stealing, but that it's also illegal. And the reason why it's illegal is because the product that you make is not a 25-cent piece of plastic in the shape of a circle, but it's a $100 million investment that you put into a movie. But how could you square saying that your product is this movie, this content, while at the same time, you know, if my DVD or my CD or my audio tape breaks and I call you up and say, you know, could you send me another one? Or, you know, even I'll pay you the nominal fee that it costs you to make a new disc for a replacement. Then suddenly your product is the 25-cent disc and you can't get another one unless you bought it. Don't you see a contradiction there?
Well, let me just, the answer is no. That's a short answer. Let's take about you make your own glasses. They belong to you. You created those glasses. Mm-hmm. If you want to make your own movie, you can do that. And you can give it away.
I created the CD. Created it.
No, but I'm saying you made your glasses. They didn't exist before you did it. The DVD belongs to someone else. Now, if you want to go out and make a 15, 20, 30-minute movie and put it on the Internet, and a lot of people do that, you have a perfect right because it belongs to you. You can do then whatever you choose to do. Your labor, your intellect, your imagination went into that. So I don't see a contradiction there at all. You make the glasses, they're yours. Now, they may not look exactly like, or maybe you made them almost like the glasses you bought at the, well, at Tiffany's, I doubt if you can do that, but let's say you bought it at the department store. What's wrong with that? Nothing wrong with it. So that's why I don't see a contradiction in it. I can't hear you, dear. Can you get off to the mic? And ladies first.
The reason I think your analogy is accurate is that if you buy a glass and you break it and you want a new one, someone has to produce that extra glass. And a glass manufacturer gets an extra profit from each glass that's sold. You as a motion picture, you know, a motion picture industry or company has sold the DVD already. They've made that profit from you purchasing it. And when that person gets, you know, if they make a backup copy, the motion picture industry has not lost that extra amount of money that they would have, you know, they can still sell it to all those other people in the way that the glass manufacturer cannot sell that extra glass that they have made to, you know, whoever else would have bought it had this person not broken it.
That's a marvelous counter argument, but it has one irremediable flaw. When you say you buy a DVD and you got to make a profit, no, the DVD, that they have to sell millions and millions and millions of DVDs before they can even begin to look at a profit. Every time a movie is stolen by somebody with sophisticated equipment and that you have it at this university, the possibility is that you're not going to see it at a theater. Or you've already got a DVD, so you're not going to buy one. Keep in mind that the glass, every time a glass is sold, there is a profit margin in that. The glass didn't cost very much. But a $100 million movie has got to exhaust itself through maybe a year or a year and a half in the marketplace, in venue after venue after venue, and maybe after 2, 3, 4, 5 years, it gets its money back. That's the difference.
Right, and that's taken care of by the fact that DVDs and movies are patronized by a large number of people. Further, I mean, I think your figures about how much money certain movies lose, I mean, those are made up for by the vast amounts of money that other films make. I mean, one company might make 2 out of 10 losers per year, but the 8 out of 10 ones that make so much money, I mean, they more than compensate for that. Because so it's, I think it's a little disingenuous to, you know, portray the movie industry as being, you know, poor movie industry. They're losing money on these films because, you know, they more than make up for that. But I mean, regardless of the fact that a movie has to be sold a whole bunch of times in order to make a profit, the fact is you only sell that DVD or movie ticket or anything to one person once. And that is on what you rely to make the profit. You don't, I mean, I hope that you don't rely on people breaking their DVDs and having to buy new ones or, you know, making fault. I mean, in that case, you could just make faulty ones that would die out every 5 years and make people have to, you know, it just seems, I mean, but, well, I mean, some do. I mean, DVDs certainly get scratched. They're not forever. I mean, half the time I go and rent a movie from Blockbuster, you know, it doesn't work right. So advanced. So I think also, you know, saying that a DVD is forever, I mean, if you're going to say that, then I think it's a contradiction to then say it's forever, but if your, you know, neighbor puts Play-Doh on it, you have no recourse.
Well, I'm saying to you that unlike a vinyl record, unlike a video cassette, it lasts forever. It never wears out. That's the point I'm trying to make. And by the way, you're talking about how movies make all this money. Would you like to buy Universal Studios?
If I could.
It's up for sale. And a lot of people don't want to buy it. The profit margins in the movie-making business are infinitesimally small, as any guy can tell you. You have to make your money in the aftermarket place. You have to go to home video. You have to go to television. You have to go to cable. You don't make it in the theatrical business. That's why this aftermarket is so bloody important. And that's why the theft of our material abducted in its early days. And then I'm not worried about today. If we could just keep everything the way it is now, guess what? We could live with that. No problem. But I'm worried about 04, 05, 06, and 07, when the capacity of technology that is beyond your imagination allows you to bring down a movie in a twinkling of an eye, the most sophisticated, great fidelity to sight, sound, and color. When that happens with 50 million homes on broadband, with every university on broadband, we have, as I said before, a big-ass problem, and that's our...
Oh, I understand. I don't see how any of that, I mean, as nice as that is, I don't see how any of it addresses the problem of someone who's already paid for a DVD. And, I mean, they're not going to distribute it to anyone else. They just want to be able to see that DVD that they already paid for. And the reason it's not the same as, you know, getting another glass that has to be manufactured is that the motion picture industry will not lose anything by this person having had a backup of that thing so that they can still, you know, use it. And instead, this person has to go and spend, you know, the amount of money to...
May I embrace you affectionately and say, let us be warm and loving friends. We just don't agree with each other.
All right.
I hate to break this up, but we do need to wrap this up. I want to just give a few thank yous. First, for all of you who have come, we appreciate your attendance here. It's a great crowd, and I know there are students and folks from other departments and faculty here, and I appreciate everyone's coming. I want to thank Kip and Meredith Fry for sponsoring this lecture. This was certainly a big success, and of course, to you, Mr. Valenti, for your very provocative and exquisitely delivered remarks and answers to questions. Thank you very much.
Highly controversial.